In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'm joined today by Paul Collins. He began his career in The Nerves alongside Peter Case and Jack Lee, and responsible for the original version of Hanging on the Telephone that Blondie would cover. From there, he went on to form The Beat and later The Paul Collins Beat. He's also issued a number of solo albums, and the latest is called Stand Back and Take a Good Look, which features our recent coolest song in the world, I'm the Only One for You. I'll play a portion of that now, followed by my chat with Paul on your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest today for our coolest conversations, American writer, author, music producer, and multi-instrumentalist, Paul Collins. His latest album is Stand Back and Take a Good Look. It's available next Friday the 16th from Gem Records, and it features our coolest song in the world this week, I'm the Only One for You. How are you, Paul?
I'm doing great, and thank you for having me on the show. It's great.
Well, thanks for joining me. You know, from what I understand, you were born in New York City, currently living there. But you weren't actually raised in New York City, were you?
Yes and no. It took me a really long time to get back there, back here. You know, I did a 15-year stint out in California, which is really where I started my career in The Nerves and The Beat and all that stuff. And then when I was a pretty young kid, my mom and my stepdad took our family. We lived in Vietnam for a while. We lived in Greece. So I got to travel all over. I was not really an army brat, but it was kind of like an army brat because my stepdad was a civilian connected with the service. So he wasn't actually military. He was an engineer. And my mom was a very free spirit, so she just loved to travel. And we just kind of bounced around. But then, you know, I graduated high school and everything here in New York, well, actually in New Jersey.
In New Jersey, do you have any siblings?
Yes, I have two older sisters and a younger brother. And at a coincidence, I didn't know it at the time, but I went to the same high school as Anthony Bourdain, who I'm obviously very sad that he decided to leave us, but I'm a huge fan of his.
Well, I read somewhere that you had gone to Juilliard. And so there must be some type of music history in your family. I mean, did your mom?
No. What happened was my mom actually did a lot of, it's very, you know, I have one of those moms that's kind of very instrumental in key points of my life. And that one was one day having breakfast, having my Cheerios or whatever. My mother comes into the kitchen and goes, "Get dressed. We're going to Juilliard. Today's the last day of auditions." And I'm like, "Mom, what are you talking about? I play rock and roll music. I'm never going to get into Juilliard." And actually what had happened is I had done a project with my mother, who's an extremely talented artist. We had done this kind of like avant-garde project together where she did these abstract paintings on slides, and I did this kind of like abstract avant-garde music using synthesizers and tape speeds and drums and flutes and pianos. So I took that tape in and I got accepted the very same day. It was kind of a mind blower.
Wow. So your mom drops this on you and you go, hey, what are you talking about? I mean, I'm a rock and roller. So when did you start playing playing music? Did you start on a guitar or what?
No, actually, I started with pencils. I wanted to play music so bad ever since I heard, I think it was, Big Girls Don't Cry and Lightning Strikes when I was a kid, actually in Vietnam. And I just, I thought that kind of music was just amazing. So I would just start playing, I was also like a lot of kids, kind of lazy. And I wasn't going to go through all the hard work of learning how to play guitar, piano. Like drums were something that I could just, I picked up, I literally started playing with pencils. And then later on, I made my own drum kit with a Remo snare and a foot operated garbage pail and some pots and pans. And then at a certain point, I think my mom said, well, maybe this kid really wants to get into music. So she got me folk guitar lessons and then piano lessons. Then I got a real drum set, and it kind of went from there.
So what age were you when you got started playing guitar and real drum set, et cetera?
When I was towards the end of my high school, I remember I one of the first songs I learned on guitar was Savoy Truffle by the Beatles. I just loved that song. It's a George Harrison song.
Right.
And, my mom got me folk guitar lessons, which really was instrumental in my guitar progression, because I was playing drums. I went to the guitar and I kind of approached the guitar the same way, very rhythmically. And I used those big block, power chords, open E, open A, open D, open G, open C. That was the basis for my, guitar style, which I've kept to this day. I mean, I really love playing rhythm guitar. Not everybody loves playing rhythm guitar. A lot of people that get into the guitar, the lead guitar is the flash, and that's what, everybody's impressed with. But, I'm a huge fan of lead guitar. I don't really play it. Although I did play the lead solo on the song you like, Will You Come Through. The folk chord was kind of like the basis of my rhythm guitar playing.
Well, so you start learning guitar and you get a proper drum set. And you mentioned you graduated, I guess you were living in New Jersey by that point. Did you play in any bands when you in your teen years, in your high school years?
Yep. My first band was called Homegrown. And yeah. I met these guys. They were a little bit older than me. And Joe and I remember his name, Joe Reardon. I hope he's still alive. I haven't heard from him since then. But they had this band called Homegrown. And I was living in a house with my family, and we had the all-famous basement. And I guess these guys, they weren't living at home anymore. They were kind of that much older than me. And I had a basement. And one day they show up in a Ford Bronco loaded down with like, I don't know, maybe $10,000-$15,000 worth of brand new equipment, a PA, an ARP synthesizer, a drum set for me, amps, yeah. Guitar. And my stepfather's watching them bring this in and he's going, I know something's going on here. Where did all this stuff come from? And no one ever really got to the bottom of that, but it was a little bit suspect. So that was my.
You're telling me it fell off the back of a truck.
And I think that was kind of like the official line. Yeah, we just found it in the parking lot. And but the synthesizer was the ARP. The ARP came out with this portable synthesizer. It was awesome. And they left it there. So I was like, I used that to make this tape that I got into Juilliard. And that thing was incredible. I spent many wonderful hours just experimenting with this ARP synthesizer, getting all kinds of crazy sounds. So, but that was my first band. And then from there, you know, I really didn't have a long history of bands because I moved out of, I left home very young at 17, moved into New York, tried to find a band in New York, and it was impossible. There were just no, there was nobody really doing rock and roll. Everything was jazz fusion or extremely experimental. And that just, you know, I was a kid, I wanted to rock out. So my next band after that was really The Nerves.
Right. And you mentioned that a few moments ago, you were talking about how your rock and roll career didn't really start until you got into San Francisco. I guess this was about 1974. What got you from New York to San Francisco?
A phone call. Megan Kunze called me up. She was a girl I knew in high school. We had been to some shows together at the Fillmore East. And she said, I'm driving to California. You want to go? And I had, at that point, I had pretty much traveled almost all over the world with my family. My mom had taken us, you know, Vietnam, Greece, and through Europe. And I had, but I had never been out, off the East Coast in the United States. And, you know, I had this thing lodged in my mind, you know, go West, young man. And so I did. So when she called me and she said, I'm going to California. And I had just reached the end of my line, so to speak, in trying to find a rock band in New York. And my drum teacher had told me, he said, look, you want to play rock and roll, you got to go out to California. So when she called me, I said yes. And I don't know, about a week or so later, we split. And that kind of changed my life. I got to California. I had probably just turned 18. And on the third day, I went to the Don Ware's music store, Music City, and I got the index card with the Jack Lee's number on it. And the rest, as they say, was history. I mean, it really was a fairy tale kind of thing.
Can you describe this for a moment? Because you mentioned going to the store and getting Jack Lee's phone number. And so we live in a different era. So how did you know to do that? You know what I'm saying?
Okay, well, back in those days, you know, this is all pre-computer, pre-cell phone, pre-everything. There were only a very few ways to find, you know, guys to play with or people to play with. And at obviously at that point, at 17, there were obviously female musicians, singers and stuff like that. I remember listening to Rita Coolidge and Carole King. But really, when I thought of starting a band, I was looking for other guys. And either you lived in a town and you knew the 10 people that played music, or you went to a music store and you went to the bulletin board where, especially in the bigger towns, where there would be, you know, people would put, you know, adverts up. And they ranged everything from like what Jack had put up, which was a three by five index card that just said wanted all original drummer to play or wanted drummer for all original music, out of the Beatles and the Stones, which is all I needed to hear. And, or there were more like flyers with, you know, top 40 band, you know, must have suit and, you know, Marshall stacks and transportation or stuff like that. You know, so it ranged from, you know, the bigger bands that were making money that were looking for somebody. But obviously, there were very few bands at that point in time, I'm talking 1974, that even played this kind of music. It was a funny thing that happened in that time frame. You know, Chuck Berry and the Beatles and that whole thing had kind of come and went. And everybody was talking about like Yes or Fleetwood Mac or Santana or Doobie Brothers. It wasn't rock and roll like that kind of rock and roll. Like if you talk to somebody about playing Chuck Berry, they go, oh, man, Chuck Berry, man, that's old hat. And I'm going, what do you mean that's old hat? This stuff is great. You know, it'll be great 100 years from now. So, but at that point in time, you know, Frampton, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Or ELP and, you know, Santana, everything was, they weren't doing like 3-minute pop songs. Let's put it that way. And so to find a advert for someone looking for somebody to play that kind of music was like a needle in the haystack. And I remember I took it down. I said, I'm taking this thing down. I don't want anybody else to see it. So I just took the card down crossed the street to a payphone, called him up, and went directly to his house.
And so Peter Case was also in the nerves. So when you called Jack, was Peter already lined up, or you? How did you get him in the loop? Yeah,
it was a funny thing. When I got to Jack's house, he was living in a real funky rooming house. I mean, you know, nobody had any money. Everybody was broke. And I had just arrived at San Francisco, and San Francisco in 1974 was about as different as you could get from New York as it was geographic. Everything was different. We didn't have plants in New York. People didn't have big green leafy plants in their house and shit like that. And New York, everything was like falling apart and dirty and hadn't been cleaned in 18 million years. You know, it was just funky. I mean, it was great, but it was funky. And so San Francisco was, you know, have a nice day. And do you want sprouts on your sandwich and stuff? And how about avocado? I go, what are you talking about? I'd never even seen like sprouted whole wheat bread at a deli. And so I get to his place and he plays me the acetate of, you know, and first of all, I had never even met anybody that had actually made a recording. So that alone, like, I was like, you know, completely blown away. And so he plays me Hanging on the Telephone, and I'm like, oh my God. And I'm going like, this is it. I mean, I hit the mother lode on the first try, and, you know, in probably 2 weeks, we're going to be millionaires. You know, I'm a kid.
So you said he played you an acetate. Let me interrupt for a moment, Paul, because he played you an acetate. So he had taken a demo version of Hanging on the Telephone.
Yeah, they had
recorded that himself.
And you can find this. It's somewhere out there online. He had done a band recording with the drummer and a bass player, and him and one of the original members of the Nerves. He didn't last long, but he was a childhood friend of Jack's, Pat Stengel, and Pat was a lead guitar player. So the original acetate recording has Pat playing lead guitar. And Peter Case doesn't play on that. But the way things unfold is the index card kind of intimated that there was a band, this was a band looking for a drummer. So I hear this song and I go, okay, this is awesome. And I'm looking at him and I'm going, well, where's the rest of the band? And he goes, forget about them. And then of course I'm a New Yorker. So I'm going, whoa, red flag here. What do you mean forget about them? He says, we're going to start a new band. So I was a little bit taken aback, but again, I was so impressed by Hanging on the Telephone. I didn't want to screw it up. So I go, okay, well, you know, what are you talking about? And so he tells me about Peter Case. What I didn't know at the time was that he, Peter Case, and Pat Stengel had been, you know, hanging around together, trying to do projects for quite some time, but it never worked. And so it was like an on again, off again thing. But they knew each other, and they knew each other for more than 10 minutes. They really knew each other. Now, I did not know that. And when I met Peter, which was that same day, I think, I said, okay, well, let's go. You know, he said, I know who we need to get to start the band, at Peter Case. And he's probably playing down at the Wharf with his buddy Danny. So I said, let's go. So we did. We went down there and we saw Peter. But and Peter was like, you know, because Jack said, you know, like, all right, now don't say anything. Just take it easy. I know how to talk to Peter. You know, Peter's, you gotta be careful how you present ideas to Peter. He's you know, a cagey guy or whatever. And so first thing I say is, hey man, you want to start a band with me and Jack? Because I'm like raring to go. Jack's like, shit, I told you not to say anything. And Peter's like, I don't know, man, you know, everybody's starting bands. And it's kind of funny. He's like, something like, you know, everybody's starting to start a band and I'm thinking of starting one myself and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, yeah, but not like this one. This is going to be great if you have Jack songs. Anyway, so.
Well, let me ask you this, Paul. So you show up at Jack's place, you say, hey, I'm a drummer. And he's like, that's great. We'll have a band. He hasn't actually heard you play yet.
Actually, he has. He starts playing songs to me on his Rickenbacker guitar, sitting on his cot. And I'm playing drums. I bring my sticks with me. I'm playing drums on a phone book. And we just immediately lock in. And I wish you know, in my mind's eye, because we did the next thing that happened is when Peter did join the band, the three of us would sit in Jack's room, unplugged, and rehearse the set. And I have to say that that's probably one of the musical highlights of my life.
Yeah.
Just the three of us sitting there, Peter and Jack singing the harmonies. I was barely able to sing at that point. I would chime in here and there. But I'm telling you, man, as a musician, it didn't get much better than that for me.
And also, I guess we should point out for people, we're making this assumption, but just in case they don't realize, when we're talking about Hanging on the Telephone, we're talking about the song that Blondie would cover and, you know, have a lot of success with. But as the Nerves, it appeared on this, was it like a four-song EP?
It was a four-song, 45 EP, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that EP also featured one of your songs, at least one of your compositions, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was the one nice thing about the Nerves. And Jack was sensitive to that. He knew it was key to keeping everybody enrolled. And it was right and fair only because the material was there. He would have never done it if he thought the music was subpar, that we each had a song on it. So he had two songs because he had many more written songs than us. And Peter had When You Find Out, and I had Working Too Hard. And obviously, they're all really good songs.
Yeah. Well, no, I believe Jack passed away like last May from cancer. Did you two guys maintain any type of relationship over the years?
Yeah, I didn't really have much, any unfinished business with Jack. You know, we both really, I don't know, whatever word you want to use, but we really cared for each other and we knew it. He was a very special person to me. And we maintained there was a long period in the 90s where we didn't speak and we kind of really totally lost track with each other.
Yeah.
And then I tracked him down when I was living in the East Village. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like one of those things after not talking to him for maybe 10, maybe 15 years, it's like, who is it? Jack, it's me. It's Paul. Oh, hey, Paul, what's going on? And it was like, no time. It's like, it could have been yesterday that the last time I talked.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing we had and the kind of person he was and the kind of person I was. And, you know, he passed away. It's still kind of recent for me. Yeah. And I know that as time goes on, there are going to be moments when like, oh man, I can't talk to him anymore, you know? And, but yeah, he was, you know, he was a very special person for me.
Well, why did the Nerves end?
The Nerves end basically the same reason why a plant in a pot dies. We didn't get any water. There was just no water. We could not get any support from anybody, professionally or non-professionally. We were totally in a vacuum and the air ran out and we suffocated.
But you guys were, so you started in San Francisco, but you had moved to LA. Yep. What prompted you to move to the Los Angeles area?
Because we could not get anything going on in San Francisco, and yeah. I mean anything. And, you know, we had to resort to like illegally setting up in a nightclub in the afternoon and starting to play without permission. That's how bad it was. Wow. So, you know, it's a funny thing. Sure. You know, and again, in my subsequent endeavors in the Beat and sort of in the Breakaways, you know, then I was like, especially in the Beat, I was hustling my own stuff. It was all my own songs.
Yeah.
In the Nerves, I was like almost like a bystander. I was like, I didn't write those songs, and I was sitting there playing them going, you know, come on, man. These are mega hit singles. There's no way we're going to miss. I mean, it was inconceivable. I'd grown up listening to WABC record and ABC radio in Long Island. I knew what a hit was. I mean, I knew it. I'd spent years listening to radio, and I knew these songs were potential hits. And if they weren't potential, you know, number one hits, they were at least damn good radio font. And we just, you know, we couldn't, we were just not in sync with what was going on. And so It really didn't happen. And it continued to not happen. Even when Blondie put out Hanging on the Telephone, which flipped me out. First time I heard it, I was driving down the street in Sunset Boulevard, and I practically got into a wreck. You know, because you know what I mean? You got to understand. We lived, breathed, and died music. And the only thing we could think about is having a hit. That was the Holy Grail. That was everything. We would have cut off our pinkies to have a hit. And here it is on the radio, and I'm going, it really took me a minute to compute in my brain what was happening, because I didn't know that they had done the song. I didn't, you know, I had went and met their management team in New York and presented them the record to see if we could play with them. Yeah. And they weren't interested. So I did not know that they had taken this. And then
were the nerves still active?
We had done the tour, and the tour was really kind of like, it was the last straw of like 3 or 4 years of just a monumental expenditure of energy to try to get this thing going.
Yeah.
I mean, really just a monumental effort. And when we got back from the tour, it was like, it was almost like nobody had to say anything. It's like, well, okay, you know, what do we do now? It was almost like we just needed to just like, we didn't do anything. We didn't talk to each other. You know, maybe I saw Peter once in a while. So there was just like this anticlimactic nothingness. And then of course, when we heard Hanging, and then, we heard, you know, the guy that we were working with in a semi-management capacity, which wasn't really manager, roadie, whatever, Ron Camacho, who's living in Vegas now, I think. He's like, Blondie wants to find Jack. Blondie wants to find Jack. We're going, what's up? And then the whole thing unfolded. And of course, then Jack disappeared again. This is not the age of cell phones. He moved. We didn't know his new phone number, and he was gone. And then the Paul Young thing happened, and he was really gone. I was going, holy moly, this guy, you know, he's on the superstar track now.
Right, and you're talking about Paul Young doing one of Jack's compositions.
Yeah, Come Back and Stay, another fabulous song that I love very much and would love to record one of these days. But yeah.
So the nerves end initially are you with Peter Case and the Breakaways?
Well, then what happened was I was the youngest of the three, so I was like devastated and desperate, and we were in LA now, and LA back then, I mean, it's probably the same way now under the same circumstances. This is like a hard, cold, cutthroat town. There's no like San Francisco, have a nice day, peace and love. Now, this is like, get the fuck out of my way, you know, and who the hell are you? And what's the name of your label? Who's your manager? Who's your agent? Oh, you don't have one? Goodbye. So I was like, you know, petrified at the thought of like having to literally completely start over from ground zero. And again, bear in mind, I didn't know anybody. I knew Jack Lee and Peter Case. That's it. I didn't have any friends. I didn't know anybody. I hadn't gone to school there. I had no mates. I didn't have anybody even to have a beer with. So I clung to Peter, and we did the Breakaways for a while, which is another funny thing. That's a band that did maybe 5 or 10 shows and got a record release 30 years later.
Yeah. Wow.
And then, of course, again, you were talking about how do you meet people. I don't know if it still exists, it probably does. There was this little weekly paper called The Recycler. And The Recycler was like a classified want ad papers from everything, you know, people selling their cars, their stereos or whatever. And there was a little section in the back, you know, bands looking for musicians. And so I guess I had put an ad in. I guess Peter and I had simultaneously put an ad in separately, looking for a bass player, and Steve Huff answered. And that's when that was another major change in my life. Steve and I started working together initially with Peter, and then Peter dropped out. And that's when we formed the beat. And then, you know, and then things moved really fast in comparison with the way they had moved in the Nerves.
So when the beat starts, I know, happening, I mean, you've done all this work with the Nerves and, you know, and just that had been really frustrating. So that first beat album comes out, you must have felt like this, you know, you're on the rocket to stardom.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we would drive around town screaming out, you know, I'd pull up to Larry Whitman's house and scream out, "Who's your manager? Who's your record company?" You know, so we were like Free Ride 21, and we were, all we needed was the Millionaire part, and we were set.
Well, that eponymous album, the beat, comes out like in 79, and two of the tracks on there, Don't Wait Up For Me and Rock and Roll Girl, you played on American Bandstand even.
Yeah, that was, I didn't realize, you know how it is, you know, I'm still a kid. I didn't realize how big a deal that was at the time. I do now, you know, because I've a million times. You guys played American Bandstand? I can't believe it. That is just so incredible. And obviously it was, but we were like, you know, okay, yeah, so what? And, you know, we get there.
But are you actually playing live? Or is it, it doesn't seem like.
We were lip syncing. We were experts at that because we knew our stuff, you know, and we didn't mess around. There were, you know, when we played Rock and Roll Girl, we played it the same way every single time.
Yeah.
So whether we were lip syncing or doing it live, you know, it was always the same, and we were pretty precision oriented. So no, that's all lip syncing, but it looks live because
it does look live. Yeah, yeah. So it's funny. Dick Clark comes over and does this brief interview with everybody, and he says something to the effect I guess I don't know if it's the guitar player or the bass player. I'm thinking second guitar player. He says something to the effect of what do you do with your downtime? And the guy says, oh, mainly collect records.
Yeah, that was Larry. That was Larry, yeah.
Oh, man after my own heart there. That's great.
Oh, yeah. Larry was a huge record collector. Steve was, he didn't collect records, but he was the consummate musician. I mean, to give you an example, he lives in Reading. And years later, after this whole thing had died down, he was in Reading, and you know the 50s band, the Ink Spots, right?
Yeah.
Now the Ink Spots are playing an engagement in Reading where he lives, and the bass player dies. If you look it up, the bass player died in Reading, California, and while they're doing this gig, you know, it was probably a week long engagement or something like that. Steve sits in without rehearsal and just stands behind the piano player and cops the thing perfectly. And there's a video somewhere of the main guy, the Ink Spots, going, "Oh, there, Steve Huff. He's amazing. He's a very, very good musician." So that's how good Steve was. Steve was my music, the absolute perfect musical foil for me. You could not get anything by him. If it wasn't good, he didn't care. It was either good or it wasn't. And you could never, he would never, you know what I mean? He would never tell you it was good if he didn't think it was good. And if he didn't think it was good, he really wasn't that interested in doing anything.
You know, you continued as the Beat and then the Paul Collins Beat for many years. But the new album's just under your name as a solo release. And you've done other, you know, releases under your own name. What's the distinction between your Beat album releases and your solo albums?
If you can figure that out, tell me. I mean, sometimes it's because, all right, like the last couple of albums, first of all, you know, I'm getting older. Second of all, I don't have a steady band. What I do now is when I'm like, it's funny, we're having the record released for this at the Parkside Lounge in New York on the 16th day it comes out. And it's like, you know, come the record release of Paul Collins, Stand Back and Good Look, featuring Paul Collins Beat, Paul Meyer, Doppelgang, and the Midnight Callers. So when I play live, I use Paul Collins Beat because I figure, you know, I'm going to be doing Rock and Roll Girl and Don't Wait Up and what the hell, everybody else does it. might as well. And also because I'm afraid that if I just put Paul Collins, people are going to go, oh, he's playing solo acoustic. Well, we'll wait till he comes with the band. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so that's that. And then the album is called Paul Collins because really at that point, it was just me putting it together.
Okay.
Even though Paul Stingo, my bassist, has worked with me on the last two albums, it's really a Paul Collins project. Whereas, you know, listen, if I had my druthers, I would have been in the Beatles, you know, and had the same band for my whole life. You know, I love that. That's what I, that was my model.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, I am hugely jealous of bands like U2 who have been able to have a career of God knows how many years with the same guys. I mean, that to me is nice. But that was not the cards I was dealt. So I got to deal with it.
So the liner notes for Stand Back and Take a Good Look say that Jim Diamond produced. Had you worked with Jim before?
Yeah, this is my third record with Jim. I did King of Power Pop with him and Feel the Noise. And Jim is an expert at making records really fast that sound good for people who do not have a lot of money. And that's me.
Well, how did you wind up working with him the first time? Why did you choose to?
The first two records are because the label I was on, Alive Records, which is a sister company to Bomp Records, Patrick Boisel, he hooked me up with Jim for that reason. He said, look, you know, we work with this guy in Detroit, Jim Diamond. He's really good. He's really fast. He has his own studio. Why don't you go up there and make a record with him? I said, sure.
And that is going to Detroit.
That was then. This time, the whole thing happened so fast. It was crazy. I had been working. Where we recorded this record is at the studio of my friend Tony Leventhal. Mm-hmm. And Tony's a buddy. So I would just go over there and do stuff. You know, there was no money had to change hands or anything. He was like, I would play drums for him to get, you know, check out, get drum sounds, or we would do stuff. Or he would record me just as so he could learn how to use the studio. So we did a couple of songs. We did I'm the Only One for You and Don't Take It So Hard. And this was the last time. We had done many attempts. And so I go, okay, you know, this sounds good. Let's mix it. And when we went to mix it, I said, Tony, man, you know, you're not a producer. I'm not a producer. And this doesn't sound that great. We need a producer. And simultaneously at the same time on Facebook, I saw this post from Jim Diamond, who I thought was living in Italy or France, saying, pickles in my garden in Detroit. And I go, Detroit, he's home. So I immediately call him up. He says, yeah, I'm back in town. I said, well, listen, I just cut two songs. You want to take a listen and see if you can mix them? He goes, yeah, sure. So I sent him the two songs. He goes, yeah, that's okay. And then he goes, you know, I got to go to New York for 2 weeks to take care of these friends of mine who I knew. They're going on vacation and they want me to take care of their cats. I said, well, let's do an album. He said, yeah, sure. So we got the whole thing together and we cut the album basically in 5 days. Some of the tracks got sent out all over the country for, you know, like we sent Stand Back to Ronnie for him to put the bass on, and we sent it to Richard and Michael Mazzarella to put the background vocals on. And I sent stuff to the guys from 2020 and Shoes. But the whole thing was done in, I don't know, less than 10 days.
All right. Rock and roll, baby.
Yeah. Well, the key to that.
I want to ask you about the title track, the Stand Back and Take a Good Look at that. Is that your own composition or was that a Jack Lee song?
That's a Jack Lee song that I always loved. And when I played it with the drummer, because a lot of the stuff I just cut guitar and drums and then we added everything else. So I wanted to control the vibe and I didn't want to have a bunch of players in the room and then maybe arguments or like, why don't you do it like this or anything. I said, I'm just going to cut this the way I know it wanted to be. And everybody else is going to have to play it. And that's what happened. And when I did the intro and that build up on the G into the verse, I said, okay, this is it. And this is it. This is fantastic. And to me, it sounded like Mata Hoople or David Bowie. And I was just totally stoked. And then once the song took shape, I said, yeah, you know, this sums up what this whole thing is about. And it made everything easy from there on in. Because all these songs on this record, they're really part of my DNA. And that ties in with the album cover, which is done by Bob Gruen, and all the pictures of my records in the past. And it's kind of like me saying, okay, folks, this is where I come from. Check it out.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is I'm the Only One for You. Who wrote that?
I wrote that. That's a mid-period beat song. I had that on a cassette tape. Thank God for these cassette tapes I've kept for 30, 40 years. And I'm playing it one day, and I go, yeah, damn, that's really good. It wasn't exactly this way. The bridge wasn't kind of the way I do it now. But the riff was there, and I said, okay. And I really wasn't total, you know, sometimes you do a song, and you go, yeah, that's okay. You know, yeah, it's not my best song, and it's not my worst song. You know, it rocks. And, you know, you're always happy when you get an up-tempo song because everybody wants the bass song. Play Rock and Roll Girl. Why don't you do something like Rock and Roll Girl? And so I go, okay, that's cool. And then when the real trick in this record, and I got to pat myself on the back for one thing, is I paired the right artists with the right songs. Dwight Twilley was perfect for that song, and he brings it home, and Shoes were perfect for the two songs they did. 2020 was perfect for the two songs they did. Chris and Prairie were great on the songs they did. So everybody was matched to the right song for what they do. And it was a home run.
But you mentioned Dwight Twilley, and as we know, he passed away, and this is probably the last thing he contributed to. What was your relationship with him? I mean, did you play with him back in the day? When the Bee was first active?
No, actually, this is my relationship with Dwight. When I got to California, when I was like 18 years old, I'm walking, that's when I hear I'm on Fire. And I'm going, I heard two records in San Francisco that, you know, really before the whole Nerves thing even started, that gave me hope. Cadillac Walk by Mink DeVille, whose album cover is also on one of the, his CD is on my album cover.
Yeah.
And Dwight Twilley's I'm on Fire. I heard those two songs. And then a little bit later, I heard Shake Some Action. And when I heard those three songs, I said, okay, somebody is doing the kind of stuff that I want to be doing. Right. So I'm not completely out of my mind, and I'm not completely alone. And then years later, like in 1990 something, we played a show at the Bell House here in New York with Dwight and Shoes. And it was like a 2-day power pop festival, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I met Dwight. And Dwight is, you know, he's incredible. And then, but prior to that, we had spoken. I had spoken to him and Jan about, you know, maybe doing some shows. They had grilled me a little bit about my contacts in Europe, because they were thinking of maybe going over there. A lot of people would get in touch with me because they saw, you know, I'm this guy who goes out and tours the country, tours Japan, tours China, tours Europe incessantly, and has no management and no agent. So, you know, how does this guy do this? So they get in touch with me, and Dwight and Jan were one of those. And so, and then when I go and do King of Power Pop, you know, sometimes, not on this record, but a lot of times you make a record and you go, well, what's it called? And you go, I don't know what it's called. What am I going to call this thing? That's like the kids are the same. It's like, well, I don't know. Pick the song that you think is, you know what I mean? It's like, the kids are the same. Okay. You know, you can't call it Crying Won't Help. I should have called it Will You Listen? Because that would have been, that would have been a great title. But anyway, so on King of Power Pop, I had written the song. And I'm going, you know, I go to the label, Patrick Boisel, I go, you know, I don't know, man. What do you think? I'm thinking maybe the King of Power Pop, but, you know, maybe that's a little bit too, egotistical or whatever. And he goes, hey, listen, man, you got to have balls in rock and roll. So I said, okay, I did it. And so I'm thinking at the time, okay, Doug Feiger had passed away.
Right.
All the other guys that I knew that did this kind of music really didn't do it anymore. Peter Case was doing the troubadour blues thing, and
yeah,
and he went, you know, so and you know, so I said, you know, okay, I don't think I'm going to offend anybody by doing this, and it's all tongue in cheek anyway. So then one day the phone rings, and I pick up and I go, hello, and he goes, hey, Paul, this is Dwight, and I go, oh shit, Dwight Twilley. He's still out there doing it, and he is the king of power pop. So I go, hey, before he has a chance to say anything, I go, Dwight, man, I'm really sorry, man. You know, I don't know what I was thinking. And you know, I'm not trying to offend you, because I'm thinking he's calling me up like, who the hell do you think you are?
Right, right.
He goes, don't worry, man. You can be the king of power pop. I'll be the king of power poop. So, which tells you, know, that's the kind of guy he was. He's extremely, extremely talented musician, amazing singer, and you know, sorry that he left us. But so I had that kind of relationship with him. I could call him anytime I want. In fact, when I called him on this, there's only two people in the world that ever called me Paulie: Eddie Money and Dwight and Jan. Paulie, what do you want, Paulie? And, you know, so they said, yeah, sure. Just send us what you want us to do and we'll do it.
You know, I was recently overseas in, playing in Spain, and you've got a song titled Under the Spanish Sun on the new album. You've mentioned touring the world. So I know you must've played there over the years, a bunch of times. What are your thoughts about rock and roll in Spain versus elsewhere?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. And I'm sure any band that you talk to that has gone over and toured Spain will say Spain is one of the greatest places to play this kind of music on the face of the earth. And it is. The fans are great. The conditions are great. You book a gig, it comes with a hotel. It comes with an amazing dinner. It comes with everything you can possibly want. You can drink as much beer at the bar as you want. You know, it's a musician's dream come true. Other countries are kind of as good, but I think Spain is number one. Then you have France and Italy too, where they treat, you know, these touring rock and roll bands like royalty, as opposed to, you know, okay, here's your two drink tickets. Yeah, the dressing room is the broom closet over there. And, you know, we don't serve food.
Did you have a Spanish girlfriend at some point?
I married two Spanish women. I have two ex-wives that are both Spanish. And you can talk to my mother about that. No, so my son, Noah, I call him a sandwich mixto, because his mother is from Madrid via Segovia. And his dad is American, so he's half Spanish, half American, which gives him two passports, which is great, because he's got an EU passport and an American passport. And but Spain really is very deep inside me. I lived there on and off for 12 years. It is my second home. Mm-hmm. I have been afforded incredible generosity and love from the Spanish music fans and Spanish people in general. And to me, it's a very, very special place.
You know, the album closes out with Westbound, and you describe different adventures there. It's a pretty driving song. What's the time frame of that song? Is that like about real events there, blowing out the tires?
That's about, you asked me how what happened. That's about the trip I took with Megan Kunze. We drove across America to get to California. Yeah. We got busted in Sault Ste. Marie for one seed. In the carburetor of the car, that's where the guy found it. And she had an ounce of weed in her pantyhose, and they found that too. And they said we had to post a $200 bail, which we did and never saw again. And we just split. And that song, that's another song that just, I wrote that probably maybe sometime in the 90s. And it just, I always knew it was great, but it was never totally finished. And thank God I got it together for this album. I love that song. And Richard Exelman plays piano on it. And it's just fabulous for me.
Yeah. We can only listen to one other track off the album right now, and I want us to go out with a cut, Will You Come Through? And to me, it's got a very Bobby Fuller vibe to it. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. You know, that's another song. These songs to me, especially a song like that and Stand Back and you know, in a way, I'm the only one for you. And these are the songs that when I was starting out, when Peter played me that song, I mean, that was really the top of where we wanted to go. It didn't get any better than that for us. This is just like an A+. This is us doing the Beatles. This was where we wanted to be. This represented everything we knew and felt about what a good song was.
And so Peter Case wrote the song?
He wrote the song, and he never really recorded it. There's a version of it, you know, kind of like a home studio, home recording version on the Breakaways record. Mm-hmm. This is the first proper recording of it, and it's an absolutely killer song.
Yeah, I agree. And so do you know anything about its inspiration for the tune?
No, I can't say I do. I mean, we never asked ourselves those kind of questions. It was like, hey, I got this song. Oh, man, that rocks. Let's do it.
Well, it definitely is rocking. Well, Paul, thank you so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time and coming up with the questions and stuff. That's great. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're going to take a listen now to Will You Come Through? It's Paul Collins off his latest album, Stand Back and Take a Good Look, here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Will You Come Through? That track from Paul Collins and off his new solo album, Stand Back and Take a Good Look. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Paul for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Singer-songwriter Jesse Malin is a favorite of ours here in the Underground Garage. Last year in June, he suffered a rare stroke of the spinal column, which has left him paralyzed from the waist down. He'll join me next time around on our Coolest Conversations and update us on his recovery, as well as let us know about a couple of upcoming projects and releases he has in the works and coming out. That's Jesse Malin on your next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.